The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager. I'm happy to be with you tonight, and I've got a potpourri of subjects to discuss, including some revisiting of prior programs, so I'm going to get right into it, because I want to make sure, or try, to get in everything I want to talk about. I don't have a guest tonight. It's just going to be me that you're listening to, because I probably didn't even want to share the time so that I could cover everything. Well, first up is Tilo Sarrazin, which we know as Thilo Sarrazin, but we've been mispronouncing his name as the German, who is a regular listener and commenter, has told us in the comment section. And I'm glad that he has given the proper pronunciation of this name, and I'll try to do it right. He is, this story is taking a turn, and as you all know by now, I'm sure, he has decided to retire, to renounce, to quit the Bundesbank and release his position there. He is one who has just written this book, Germany Does Itself In, or Germany Abolishes Itself, whichever way you want to translate it, putting out quite a good position for the fact that all this immigration into Germany is doing a lot of damage to Germany. Now, our friend the German has written a long, excellent comment in the comment section, and I urge you all to read it, because he gives a very nice breakdown of what took place, and there might be more there by now. So what strikes me is that, I talked about Tilo last week, and I said I was so happy that he was doing what he was doing, but now he's giving up his post. And he says, though, that he is not going to give up his membership in the Social Democratic Party. This book makes me think of the title of it. You know, Germany Abolishes Itself. It makes me think of the title of the 1941 book, Germany Must Perish, by Theodor Kaufmann, which advocated, actually, the sterilization of Germans and the mating of German women with non-German men, and keeping German men outside the country and mating with non-German women. Now, this book was accepted as a respectable book at that time, 1941, at the time of the anti-German war hysteria in the United States. It was published, self-published by this author, but it got reviewed, and it was being sold in stores and so on. And now Sarrazin's book is coming out and is supportive of maintaining Germany in its character, and his book is decried and railed against as evil. This is just so unbelievable. Why are people allowing this to happen? Why are they doing this? If we didn't see this going on with their own eyes, what these leaders in Germany are doing, how they are demonizing this man, and as soon as he says anything like against the immigration policies or against what these immigrants are doing to the character of the German nation, he is attacked viciously, immediately and right away. Oh, we have to fire him. He can't hold his position. What he's saying is going to upset, be so divisive. Oh, they bring that up. It's going to be so divisive of the nation. We can't have any division, which means we can't have any debate. we must all just accept what our policies are and not speak out about them, because it's going to upset things. We can't upset anything. We might lose something in the process. I think this is how the people have been convinced to stay quiet and to accept these things, because they're afraid, and they've been told, and they believe that if they go against the prevailing wishes and beliefs and political stance of the European Union and others, the United States, etc., and so on, and of course Israel, will suffer economically, and they will suffer then in all kinds of other ways. And their memory of the suffering of Germany after World War II, and actually after World War I, and between the wars, and then a few good years, and then more attacks and the total devastation by the rest of the world because of what they were standing up for. And they can't see that that's going to benefit them, because it didn't bring about any lasting good into their minds previously. So this is the problem that we have with the Germans, the German people actually standing up for themselves and for their country. Zaratsin himself says that he's gotten calls, letters, and emails, 99% in support of him and of the congratulatory type. And he's very proud of that. That speaks well of Germans, because previously, they have been unwilling to even do that, to even support. And they've also sent thousands of emails to the to the Bundesbank. They said the last I saw was a number of 4,000 emails that they had received. To go back to the book Germany Must Perish by Theodor Kaufmann. Now, Theodor Kaufmann is Jewish. Was Jewish. He's probably dead now. This was a Jewish plan to destroy Germany. And they came right out with it. I mean, many others did too. Came right out with their desire. They were pushing the idea, which never quite took hold, that the Germans were such a flawed nation, such a flawed race, that they really needed to be done in, and if not, at least they had to be mixed, their blood had to be mixed with others, and they had to be weakened, and probably Germany would have continued to be in that crushed state after World War II, except for the break between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies, and therefore now the Soviet Union became the new enemy, and Germany was too vulnerable to being taken over by them, and so they decided, well, we have to quit doing this to Germany. We have to strengthen them and make them a partner with us in order to fight off the Soviet Union, which now they finally saw as for its true nature. All sides want Germany for their own use. They want to take advantage. They want to take control of the Germans and put the Germans to work for themselves. The Germans are the hardest working, the most competent, the most capable nation of people in Europe, and Europeans can't do without the output and the economy that the Germans can provide, and therefore, but they want to keep the Germans kind of in a slavish or in a controlled situation where they cannot break out on their own in any way, that they continue to work for the rest of them. So it's very similar to what the Jews want, and of course the Jews play a big role in the power structure of Europe and of these individual nations, because and they're a big role in the immigration that comes into these, that's been, well, it's been turned into a policy that we're going to have all this open immigration of all types. Whoever is in the European Union gets to emigrate all around into other countries. So this helps to break down national feelings and national loyalties, and this is in their interest. So I hope that the people will continue to support him, and he will continue to be a spokesman for this. he's already sold many, many copies of this book, and they've in the fourth or fifth printing. And if he could be, you know, it could become a bestseller. He could become very wealthy from the book itself, if it gets translated. And of course, he's freer to do all this if he's not in a Bundesbank member. But at the same time, he is easier to destroy if he's not in the Bundesbank. So we'll have to wait and see what happens there. But it's very possible that he could become a nucleus for a movement. Whether he's willing to do that or not, as I said, remains to be seen. Another good story here is European Union condemns France's expulsion of Roma. And I want to talk about that a little bit because it's just so it's so ironic that the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, is in the forefront of expelling gypsies from France when he has been such a proponent of immigration and equality of all people and all of these North Africans and black North Africans. They're legitimate French citizens and they're Frenchmen and et cetera, et cetera. We're not going to allow anybody to say that they're not. But somehow the gypsies are just so unpopular. It's very interesting. And he, in spite of the fact, now France has just recently expelled 1,000 Roma migrants, or otherwise called gypsies, from their country back to Bulgaria and Romania. This is where they originated. This is where they originally came from India, but they've now their original nation is more like Bulgaria and Romania. And Bulgarians and Romanians don't like them and are happy to export them, but the rest of Europe is not liking them at all. And this is just not sitting well with the European Union and its type of policies and humanitarian beliefs. France says that the European Union is exceeding its prerogatives and is resisting what it's the Union's rebuke on them, because, and they say that these people who are coming in are not working, and they have a rule that they're welcome to come, but they, after 3 months, I think it is, they have to, after 3 months, they have to find employment. And if they haven't found employment, they can be expelled. So it's not like they're all equal citizens in the European Union. You still have national citizenship, and they just have the right to travel around. That's what they have the right to do. So here's the thing. It says in the past year, 10,000 Roma were shipped home to Romania and Bulgaria from France by the French government. And they give them €300, and for, if they will voluntarily go. And many, many of them take it, and they took the money and left voluntarily, but they can just come right back, and they probably will. Now, a little background on these gypsies is interesting. They originated in India, and they left sometime in the 11th century. And by the 14th century, they had entered Eastern Europe. And the people of Eastern Europe somehow got the impression they came from Egypt and called them gypsies from the word Egypt, Egyptians, you know, gypsies, short for Egyptians. So they are estimated to be about between 2 and 5 million. Now that's pretty wild. It shows they have no census of these people, because there's a big difference between 2 million and 5 million. But they don't really know. It's just like Hispanics in the United States, illegal immigrants in the United States. There's this estimate, but nobody really knows how many there are. You'd think they could get a better count of gypsies in Europe. But in spite of the fact that they've been around so long, been living there so long, Europe has never accepted them. This is from a Time magazine article. There's a big kind of a spread in the last current Time magazine that I looked at on the internet, and it had all this in it. You can look at it too. And there have been purges of the gypsies here, there, you know, of different places. across all this period of time because the people just don't like them. Well, why don't they like them? Because they're different. And, you know, this whole idea that we're taught now that difference is good and we should enjoy having all these different people around because it makes it more interesting and it gives us, makes for a stronger nation, it makes for a stronger people, it makes for all kinds of positive things, that just isn't true. And we really don't like people to live among people that are very different from ourselves because they don't have the same habits, they don't have the same values, they don't have the same way of life, and it becomes a very disruptive, conflicting experience. Also, this article points out, it doesn't point out what I just said, but it points this out about the how we've used the word gypsy in our language, like the word gyp. It's when we cheat someone out of money, it's usually out of money, we gyp them, you know. And gypsy moths are parasitic moths. I didn't know that. I know there was gypsy moths, but I didn't know why they were called that. But they're called that because they're parasitic. And then there's something, taxi cabs that operate illegally are called gypsy cabs. So there you have, it's a general acceptance that you can't trust gypsies. And if you, and it's true, they can be charming and likable, and they have some fun qualities and so on, like they're good dancers, especially good dancers. Of course, they have their music, and I love gypsy music, which is really Hungarian music, or maybe some Romanian, but I think it's mostly Hungarian rhapsodic music that I think of as gypsy music, which is, but they play that music, which is marvelous. But anyway, a few gypsies would be all right, but when there's too many, then it's a problem. Now, this Time magazine article also says they found it difficult to build permanent settlements or find jobs, and that's why they bounce around from country to country. See, this is the way they present it, like, as usual. It's not their fault. They're not able to be permanent or find jobs, and that's why they're the way they are. No, they're the way they are because that's the way they are. They don't build permanent settlements and find jobs because they don't want to. Now, another thing about the gypsies, the Nazis, you know, the word is, in this Time magazine article says, the Nazis murdered roughly 400,000 gypsies. Well, this is totally untrue. Careful study, and I have studied it, the situation has shown that it was about 20,000 gypsies died during World War II. And the Roma themselves now claim 1 million, because they want to cash in like the Jews do. So they kept building up their numbers. And how does this get any credibility? The media carries this stuff, even though it's been proven to be untrue. But this Time magazine is satisfied with saying roughly 400,000, which is way over two. That's almost 500,000. The recent upset that started this recent return of gypsies was a July 16th incident in which 22-year-old Luigi Ducane was shot by police after he drove through a roadblock and allegedly hit an officer. Well, it says allegedly hit, who knows, but he drove through a roadblock and they shot him. And here's his name, Luigi. Well, that's kind of Italian, but it could be something Romanian too, but Ducane, that's a French name. So this gypsy has taken on a French name, or Frenchified his name or something, I don't know. But the fact that he was killed sparked a riot in this little town in France, and it prompted a government spokesman to say that gypsies were sources of illegal trafficking, of profoundly shocking living standards, of exploitation of children for begging, of prostitution and crime. And on July 28th, Sarkozy announced that Roma encampments would be dismantled and their inhabitants systematically evacuated. So that's what they've been doing. And Sarkozy, who is a proponent of multiculturalism, is deciding he needs to get the gypsies out of his country to keep, I guess, his political career intact, but as they say, most of them will probably come back. Now, in Eastern Europe is where most of the Roma are based, as I'm sure you all know, and because they know them so well there, that's where the discrimination is most fierce. I mean, they really don't like them there. In Hungary, the Jobbik Party, which is, of course, a very far-right party, anti-immigrant party, is calling for the Roma to be forced into segregated camps. And they've come in third in their elections recently. And in the Czech government, now these Czechs who make out that they are so so tolerant and they're such victims themselves, just like the Jews of the terrible Germans during World War II, and they're so full of human rights and so on, only for themselves though. They were supposedly illegally sterilizing the Roma women even up until 2003, and they finally last year apologized for doing that. Well, this is the kind of thing that probably that's an overstatement because it's put out by a rights group. But it shows that these people are innately disliked, and nobody wants them around. Nobody wants them. So what are you going to do with them? Well, I don't know. It's interesting to watch. I want to say a few words about, because I have a loyal listener, Dean, who brought this to my attention and asked me to elaborate on the story of, the anniversary of the Britain Blitz. And the newspapers and the TV broadcasters had this big story for this. It was September 7th anniversary of the London Blitz for a home movie that family found showing some film footage of it. Oh, it was just so coincidental. But it turns out that this home movie was filmed by a air raid warden, and it was in his family's attic, they say, and they found it there. And it was actually a training film that he made because he was an air raid warden, and it was a training film for rescue workers during the Blitz. And it's also very high quality, it seems to me, that you can go on to, this story was on Yahoo News, and it's from back around, it was in September 6th, last Monday, and it's called Britain Blitz Footage. You can Google that if you want to see it, and they show you some of the film. But this listener, Dean, commented, "I've always heard that Germany did a bombing run on the UK after the UK provoked Germany extensively." Well, I did too. I have too. He wanted to know if I could say anything about that. Well, I was trying to look up the anything on that. And you know, I really had a hard time because everything was just promoting the great courage of the British during this time and so on. But I did find a timeline, and I'm not so sure just how honest this timeline is either. But it says, what I have here, I'm going to just read, on the May 15th, 1940, RAF Bomber Command begins a strategic air offense against targets inside Germany by attacking industrial installations in the Ruhr. Then on May 17th, 1940, the biggest RAF attack on Germany to date, as the oil tanks at Bremen and Hamburg are blown up. British claim 1,000 German aircraft lost in a single week. Okay, well, both of those are industrial, but they are inside Germany. Then the May 24th, 1940, the first British civilian bomb casualties are reported. Well, this is not necessarily London or the Blitz. It's just that there was at least one civilian or a few civilians that they say died, which can certainly happen when you were doing bombing back then. So on the July 9th, it says, RAF begins night bombing of Germany. So there it is. And this is before there was any kind of bombing of London. So it sounds to me like, they don't want to focus on that. They put that very simple little sentence and don't give you anything more. Because this whole, where this night timeline was, is very pro-British, like most of these things. So we will take our news break now and return in a few minutes.
right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair will receive a prestigious American Medal for human rights work. But in his 10 years as Premier, Blair went from being hugely popular to being called a poodle of the U.S. His policies in Afghanistan and Iraq earned him accusations of having blood on his hands. As RT's Laura Emmett reports, many are outraged at his latest award.
Tony Blair must be breathing a sigh of relief to be back stateside. The first signing of his new autobiography was cut short by protests in Dublin, leading him to cancel similar events in London when anti-war protesters intent on prosecuting him for starting a war in Iraq threatened disruption. But back in the States, he's being awarded a medal for his steadfast commitment to conflict resolution.
This is the man who introduced arbitrary detention into Britain and supported all kinds of measures which led to people being locked up and mistreated by authority, the opposite of liberty. It's one of those great cosmic jokes, isn't it? Like Henry Kissinger getting the Nobel Peace Prize. I think there are some moments in life where one just has to laugh.
Far from getting a prize, some in the UK think Tony Blair should be prosecuted for war crimes, believing his government broke international law in sending British troops to Iraq. Among those wanting Mr. Blair to be sent to The Hague is Chris Knight. He used to be a university lecturer, but was fired after taking part in last April's G20 protests in London. He went on to set up the anti-war group Democracy Village, which took over Parliament Square ahead of May's general election and stayed there for 3 months. Knight and his followers have tried to arrest members of Tony Blair's government and think Blair himself should face charges.
We really live in an upside-down world where the people who are most, in practice, subversive of democracy and freedom get awarded these medals, and those of us who genuinely fight for freedom find ourselves, chased from one place to another and even risking our jobs.
Anti-war critics say the concept of peace in the world has been turned upside down by the Western political elite in a kind of Orwellian conjuring trick, where military intervention or aggression is recast as humanitarian action. Presenting Blair with the Liberty Medal, which recognises leadership in the pursuit of freedom, is Bill Clinton, the 2006 winner. He also went to war during his presidency of the US.
Clinton is far less prominent as a war criminal because during his mandate, he was, of course, head of state when the actions were taken by NATO against Yugoslavia. But nonetheless, I would suggest that both leaders are there. They have blood on their hands.
Some estimates put the civilian death toll in Iraq at 1 million people since the invasion by the US-led coalition with British forces in 2003. After stepping down as UK Prime Minister, Tony Blair went on to become Middle East peace envoy and has toured the world as a public speaker, reportedly charging up to $400,000 for a 90-minute speech. Since leaving 10 Downing Street, Blair has reportedly made between $30 and $45 million. He received a $7 million advance for his new book, which he's donated to a charity that helps military veterans. But even that didn't go down very well at home, with critics calling it blood money. With the Liberty Medal comes another $100,000, which he'll feed into his own charities. But in the eyes of many, no amount of humanitarian work will atone for Blair's actions as Prime Minister, and they'll keep calling for his prosecution. Laura Emmett, RT, London.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager. Moving on to another topic that I wanted to cover, and this is the revisiting of what I did, what I talked about 2 weeks ago, the Hess peace mission, so-called, to Scotland in 1941. And Steve Zuba, who is another listener and who calls me once in a while with good information, he's quite the researcher and knowledgeable about a lot of things, and he told me about this article by Ernst Haiger on this Martin Allen book that I used predominantly in that program to discuss how this whole event took place. And this Haiger is a freelance historian currently writing a biography of Albrecht Haushofer. You might have to refresh yourself on that program, but I want to bring up some things that I said incorrectly, and also things that from Martin Allen's book that he very strongly disagrees with, this Haiger, and could very well be right. And so I thought I wanted to put a little bit more on the record here about this, because I'm certainly not an expert and I'm trying to get the best information I can. But the truth is, this episode is so cloudy and so misunderstood. I mean, there's so little to go on that I don't know if it's ever going to be understood. And you don't know really who and what to believe, but I think there's some good points that I might bring out right now. So Martin Allen's thesis, which I failed to bring out in that program, I said that I didn't think that Hitler knew that Hess was going to fly. But Allen's thesis was that Hitler was totally involved in the Hess-Haushofer peace negotiations and with Hess's flight. He fully approved of it, and he knew all about it. But when it went bad, then he, you know, had his plausible denial all prepared, and that's what he went, and then he went with that scene. But I don't put much credence in that. But you know, like I say, it's hard to know, and we don't know. Nobody knows, including these men who are writing these books. Now, this article, I don't think I mentioned. Did I mention it's in the Journal of Intelligence and History, and it can be found on Google Books. If you Google it on Google Books, or just Google Haiger Journal of Intelligence and History, you will come upon it. This is a book or a journal that has quite a few articles in it, and his is one of them. And I don't have the exact name of the article in front of me because I'm not going to go to it right now, but that will do it. So this is what Martin Allen came up with. And I had gone through quite a bit of what he says in his book. Certainly not all of it at all. But this Haiger doesn't have a good opinion of Allen. And he says that in a previous book, I told you about Allen's, he's been accused of putting false documents into the records and then using those false documents in his book. Now, it was never proven, and he denied it, and no, they didn't push it too much. I mean, he wasn't like taken to court or something. And then he died. But Haiger says that in a previous book by Allen called Hidden Agenda, which is about the Duke of Windsor and his, you might say, Nazi sympathies. He's a friend of the National Socialists. That in this book, Allen had used a forged document, which is known to have been a forged document. But at this point, I want to mention that forgery or dishonesty among historians is not anything new. And I took an interest last year, was it, or 2 years ago, when it came out that the very famous American historian Stephen Ambrose, who was President Dwight D. Eisenhower's official biographer, and he wrote and edited more than a dozen books about Eisenhower and other things, he's very highly thought of, it was alleged that, and then really accepted, proved or something, that he invented many meetings with Eisenhower, and he fabricated interviews with him, and he put all this stuff in his books about Eisenhower that he just made up, because he didn't actually, it was shown that he couldn't have had those interviews, that he didn't spend all that time. with Eisenhower. Eisenhower never, didn't spend that much time with him, and so on. It also mentions here that, in writing about Stephen Ambrose, that Steven Spielberg, the famous Jewish Hollywood celebrity who does all these Holocaust films, used him as a military advisor in his 1998 Oscar-winning film, Saving Private Ryan. What has Spielberg done that isn't Oscar-winning? They're all Oscar-winning. But I thought that was interesting because Spielberg will always pick the dishonest ones to associate himself with. To go on with the points in the Allen book, the differences between him and Higer, I will bring up these things. This is the Duke of Kent, okay? Some things that I said. I said the Duke of Kent wasn't involved. I was talking about the Duke of Hamilton as being the more important player, but that's actually, I was wrong. I even knew that afterwards. It's even in the Allen book. I mean, Hamilton was a good friend. This is the way it is. Hamilton was a good friend of Albrecht Haushofer. He was the son of Karl Haushofer. And he was and he was the one who was advising Hess, Albrecht. Now, Albrecht had a good and even close relationship. Well, it's close in some ways, not real close, but a very solid relationship with aristocrats who were German friendly in Britain. And he had a good relationship and a solid relationship with Hamilton. It was Albrecht Haushofer who knew Hamilton, not Hess. Hess didn't really know him, apart from meeting him, perhaps, for the first time at the Berlin Olympics. So that's another reason why Hess was depending on Haushofer. Now, also about Albrecht Haushofer, I misspoke at one point in the program, and I knew that afterwards when I heard it. I just absolutely just said the wrong name, not the one I meant. I said that Albrecht was found by the British agents, and when I meant to say that Karl was found by the British agents, Albrecht was actually arrested by the Reich Security Office after the July 20th, 1944 assassination attempt on Hitler. And this is the famous Valkyrie affair, the Valkyrie that they made the movie out of and so on. And the most famous assassination attempt on Hitler at all, the one where he actually was in that explosion, but he survived with fairly minor injuries. But that was a wide-ranging conspiracy, and they arrested lots of people, and most of them for good reason. But Haushofer was released after questioning. But later, he had been involved with the traitors, because at some point he got involved with the traitors. He wasn't involved with them in 41 when he was working with Hess. But later on, when the war was after 43 and in 44 mostly, when things were not going well in the war, many, many Germans decided that they knew better and they wanted to try to find agreement with Britain and the U.S. To work out a surrender that was that would be more fair, to Germany. They did it, they thought, as German patriots trying to help Germany, without seeming to be able to realize that the unconditional surrender policy of Churchill and Hitler was already firm and they weren't going to change it under any conditions. And Hitler knew that. He understood that. And many of those who stood by him. But a lot of them thought, well, they still had this. They couldn't believe that the British would actually want to destroy, and Roosevelt too, just destroy Germany absolutely. But they did, and so that's why they were engaging in their traitorous activities. And it wasn't just peace feelers. They were giving secrets. They were giving information to the British and so on, with the idea that that would show that how serious they were, how sincere they were, and that they wanted to be friends and so on. Now, Samuel Hoare, the meeting of Hoare and Haushofer in Madrid, which I spoke about, because Martin Allen makes, that's very important in his book, that there was this meeting that took place in Madrid, and when Haushofer came, if you recall, and said, we want a meeting with a representative on neutral territory, and we need to have that take place now, because the British weren't following up on anything properly. And so, but Hyder says he doesn't think that meeting took place, and he doesn't believe that Samuel Hoare played that role that Martin Allen says he did. He thinks that Allen's evidence for it is not sound, that it is a memorandum written by with someone with using the initials GAH, which are actually the initials of a naval attaché in the British Embassy in Madrid, and that's who Allen is saying is, you know, wrote it and gave out that information. But Hyder says it's hard to believe that he would, that this naval attaché would have any knowledge of this. And Allen's argument requires that this man was very much involved, and he doesn't think he could be. He also doubts a letter of March 26, 1941 that Allen produces from Hoare to Alexander Cadogan, who was a high official of either the intelligence or the foreign office, telling of a meeting with Haushofer in Madrid, that this letter is not real either. And he says it's obviously a forgery if it's been studied and it's a forgery. Hyder also does believe that Hoare was a strong supporter of appeasement, and he was not against a negotiated peace. And he doesn't think that he was secretly working for British intelligence, as Martin Allen says. I don't know. Who can say who was secretly working for British intelligence and who was really, you know, considering what kind of program they really did have. They really did have this program to fool the Germans. And so they were doing all these things. So I can't say, but naturally I can't say. But also another thing that he brings out is that the terms, in some place in the book, Martin Allen seems to accept and say that the terms Hitler was giving during this meeting in Madrid was that was one part of it was an offer to pay reparations to the occupied countries. And he says that's implausible, and I agree with that. I didn't believe it at the time when I was reading it. I can't imagine. That's an admission of guilt, in a sense, to pay. Why would Hitler go so far as to not only leave these countries, but pay them reparations? Is, you know, how much money did he think he had? I just don't know about some of this stuff. And also, okay, now we go to Ernst Bolle. Hyder says that Haushofer would never have approved Ernst Bolle in peace negotiations. You know, Ernst Bolle, Martin Allen says, was going to be the one, he was the one scheduled to travel to Scotland to as the representative of Germany. But now Ernst Bolle was head, I didn't bring this out, but he was head of an organization called the Ausland, that's in English, the Ausland organization. Well, Ausland is German, but it's the Outlanders organization of the NSDAP that kept up with the National Socialist Party members living outside of Germany. It was a very important organization in Germany and during that time and during the war especially. And Ernst Bolle was considered in a very important position. But Haushofer says that Haushofer never, always disapproved of this organization. He thought it was bad for Germany, bad for German public relations. And so he says that Allen, also that Allen makes the fantastic assertion that Bolle was going to fly to Scotland himself and that Hess made a last-minute decision to go himself. And what's wrong with that, according to him, is that Bolle was not a pilot. Well, of course he was not a pilot. Somebody else would have piloted the plane. I mean, he would have been taken there by a pilot in a plane and then brought back by that same pilot back to Germany after the meeting. But Hyder says that Hess fitted his plane with equipment, a lot of special equipment that he couldn't fit anywhere, and he put it in the second seat. So there was no second seat. Well, that's true. That's what Hess did because he was going alone. But if Bolle had gone, then that wouldn't have been done that way. But anyway, I'm not going into all the details of the plane. But then Hyder points out that Allen said correctly that Hess had spent months planning and preparing for his flight, so it wasn't a last-minute change. Well, the correctly, that Hyder said correctly indicates to me that Higer believes that Hess intended to go himself all along. And because I don't know what Higer believes. He doesn't really say in this article. He just tears into Allen. But I get from this that he thinks that Hess, it was always the plan for Hess to go. There was never any plan for someone else to go, which I do not know. And he concludes by saying, dubious and absurd interpretations of sources are Allen's specialty. And then he gives two examples that didn't seem too important to me, so I'm not going to mention them. But this might be typical of, to some extent, not totally. I'm sure there are plenty of valid criticisms of what Martin Allen wrote. There seem to be. But there's also this quibbling and jealousy between historians that goes on a lot. But okay, now, and the other point, another point is that the Brits kidnapped Hess. You know, I wanted to bring out that at the time, according to what Martin Allen said, that the British said that they couldn't send a representative to a neutral country to meet a German representative because they feared the Nazis would kidnap their representative because the Nazis weren't trustworthy. But what did they do? When Hess showed up on their territory as a peace missionary, they kidnapped him. And the reason they didn't want anybody to know that he was there or that they had him or any of it, although it got out, was because they didn't want to know that he came as a peace emissary, because they didn't want anybody to know that they were engaged in, you know, they were encouraging any peace talks, which they weren't really, but they were pretending to. So the whole thing is they make out that if Hess was not a peace emissary, then he was a leader or he was a person from a belligerent country coming into their nation, and they had the right to, you know, arrest him. I'm calling it kidnapping, but they call it arrest. Arrest him because he's the enemy. But if he's on a peace mission, they can't arrest him. I mean, it's just wrong. So that's one of the big problems with what the British did with all of that. So I really doubt that when these papers are released, that they're going to be complete and that we're still not going to know, because the British government simply doesn't want anyone to know. And there's nobody speaking for the German government. This goes back to what I was talking about in the first half hour. The German government is not, they're not for truth about World War II, truth about this National Socialist regime, truth about, for Germany. They're not for truth for Germany. They are the biggest critics and blasphemers against Germany that exist in the world. They uphold that Germany was evil. They uphold it to their to their last breath. And so you're not going to get any kind of a fair hearing on these things, because it has to be the government itself. Say, like the Japanese government was very instrumental in forcing out truth and papers and release of things about the part that they played, and things that the U.S. did, and just so many things about World War II. But the Germans don't do that, and they won't do that. And Germany is still an occupied nation. That's the thing to remember. Well, in the little bit of time that I have left, I want to tell you some new developments on the Elie Wiesel Kahn's The World website. This is a total departure from what I was talking about. Just to remind you that the person who broke this story about Elie Wiesel's imposture, even though it was many wrote and accused him of lying about all of his books and his experiences and so on, but it was this man Miklos Gruner, who has been living for quite a while in Malmo, Sweden, but who was originally from Hungary, Romania, and was a legitimate inmate of Auschwitz and Buchenwald. And in fact, his picture is in that famous Buchenwald liberation photograph that I have a whole page on the Elie Wiesel Kahn's World website. And so we know he was there. And he is the one who met Elie after he won the Nobel Prize, you know, in Sweden. And this newspaper arranged a meeting with the two of them, thinking they'd be old, you know, camp buddies and could meet. And it was a very strange meeting indeed. And after that, Nicholas Gruner, who's also calls himself Michael Gruner, started investigating because he didn't believe Elie Wiesel was the person he said he was, because he said he knew Lazar Wiesel in the camp. So anyway, that's the background. And from then on, some of the others have started investigating. And now I am deep into the investigation of all of this. And I called Nicholas Gruner on the telephone a few days ago, five, 6 days ago. And actually, Mike Connor made the call for me, and I talked to him for, maybe 20 minutes. And we had a good conversation, but I was a little disappointed. I had some requests. One was to have him come on this program as guest, but he is hesitant to do anything and say anything. And part of his reason for being evasive is that he is afraid that what he says will be used against the Holocaust and against Holocaust survivors, which he is a total believer and defender. So I understand his hesitancy, and I certainly wouldn't, because I couldn't tell him, no, it's not going to be. But he did tell me that a picture of his tattoo was taken by a Modesto, California television station when he was there in 2008, when he came all the way over here to attend the trial of Eric Hunt in San Francisco. When Eric Hunt was on trial for assaulting Elie Wiesel, as you all recall, and he is a pretty nice man, in spite of the fact that his beliefs are different than mine and ours, but he did make that trip because he wanted to help Eric Hunt, because he saw Eric Hunt as helpful in the effort to expose Elie Wiesel. So Nicholas Gruner has a little bit of a problem there, because he wants to expose Elie Wiesel, but he doesn't want any harm done to the Holocaust story that he believes in and wants to keep intact. So that's the problem also that I would have with him, and I don't want to be dishonest with him. But it was nice talking to him. And the last thing I want to say before I close is that he says that he has a court case coming up in Hungary, in Budapest, in 2 months. And Elie Wiesel has been called as a witness, and it's hard to get things very clear, not because he doesn't speak good English, but he just doesn't want to say very much. I guess he's brought this court case to force Elie Wiesel to defend who he is, something like. I don't know how he's going to do that, but that's what he says it is. Force Elie Wiesel to tell the truth about himself or say who he is, and he'll be forced to show his tattoo. And he says, wait 2 months and all this will happen, and come over here and see it for yourself, and so on. Well, we'll see. I haven't heard anything about it except from him, but this is the effort that he's making. And he wants to keep the focus on Elie Wiesel and not on himself. So this is another thing that he doesn't like to really talk about himself too much. So, ladies and gentlemen, with that, this has been kind of I hope this has not been too confusing of a radio broadcast. I'm almost afraid to listen to it. But I felt the need to cover certain things, and I hope it has made a little bit of sense. So that's it for September 13th, and I wish you a good night. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.